Latte, ladies and gentlemen.
This is Dave Douglas. This is the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. That is the music of Nabate Isles. He'll be talking to us about his new record, about his show at Jazz Standard in January, and about all kinds of other musical interests and passions, including sports talk radio, which is a really fascinating thing for me to talk about with him. So go to greenleafmusic.com for more information. And send us an email, podcast@greenleafmusic.com, and come join us as a subscriber and get the entire catalog of releases. And now, here's Nabate. Nabate Isles, thanks for joining me.
Oh, wow. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. I almost don't know where to begin because you have not just a multifaceted history in the music, but also, you know, just a lot of different things that you do. So after listening to this record, Eclectic Excursions, I feel like the first question I have to ask is, why did it take you so long to decide to make your own record?
Yes, it was all about timing. I've always wanted to do a record, but the time didn't feel right. It didn't feel organic. It didn't feel natural. I remember I did like an EP, like I recorded like a few tracks back in 2005-ish, around 2005. So, and I wasn't really happy with it. And I'm still looking for the CD and still looking for all the recordings of that, because I like to hear it now to see, you know, what it was. So I wasn't really happy with it.
It didn't come out.
It was my playing. And I think it was good, but I felt I would have had to add more elements, like more tunes and things like that.
But it also seems like, I mean, you've been on so many records and Grammy-winning mm-hmm. records and side musician in all kinds of groups. And, you know, aside from that, we'll talk about your other career. But and then I see this record and there's so many people, you know, there's like a cast of thousands.
Yes.
And it's so diverse in terms of what the music is that I guess maybe my question was coming more from, you know, What made you feel like, okay, all these different elements of my musical life, now I can put them together in this one thing that makes sense?
Yes. No, I felt last May, it was May of 2017, I just was inspired. I just decided, just felt like, wow, I'm kind of moving into my next decade in my life of my 40s. And I was 39 at the time. And I said, okay, I think I've experienced a lot. And also I've experienced a lot from my other end, being in sports media and also doing so many different things in my life and meeting so many different types of people that have advised me throughout my life. And I felt like, okay, I'm wiser. I know that most likely I'll have to fund the record, because record companies don't give major advances anymore. It's a whole different game now.
Well, I remember when you first started talking about it, and well, I was surprised, but also it was I could tell from the look in your eye that it was going to be a long, arduous process. Like, mm-hmm. here we are 18 months later with the CD in hand. Yeah. Because you had so many different ideas that you wanted to capture. We were listening to that track, Laid Back, I mean, before you and I started talking. Mm-hmm. And
you know, there's elements of rap, obviously. There's songwriting. There's production values. Mm-hmm. There's beats. There's all this stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So, but also the record doesn't, it's called Eclectic Excursion, but it doesn't feel like it's all over the place. So mm-hmm. you must have somehow over those 18 months corralled all of those influences and experiences.
Yes. Yes, indeed, Dave. It was important. And I think it was important to get musicians that I've had such a great relationship with for some of them more than 20 years. Some like Jimmy Owens, my musical father, and Brad Jones, who was my teacher at the Harlem School of the Arts, where I did after school jazz classes in high school in the early 90s. And also Dave Gilmore, who was on the first record I ever was on, Steve Coleman, first professional record, Steve Coleman's Genesis and Open and Away. Mm. And Jonathan Blake and Jaleel Shaw, who I go way back to jazz camp, summer jazz camp, wow, back in the early 90s when we were teenagers. So I needed to have people like that with me. And then, of course, you know, many others that were on the project I've known for 10, 15 years. And then very few people that I never worked with before but really respected and really dug their artistry and wanted them to be a part of it.
So. What made you decide to get Sam Barsh to be the producer?
Oh, that cat. What a musician.
Well, I don't mean from a standpoint of qualifications.
I just mean
artistically.
But that's what I mean. Yeah, artistically, that's an eclectic cat because I wanted an album. I didn't want it to be, I didn't want it to sound the same throughout. And I wanted to have influences, musical influences from all different genres because I've said this all along, like jazz and improvisation is the root of this project, and all the other genres, soul, R&B, hip-hop, rock, all of that are the branches. It comes from the root of jazz and improvised music. So Sam Barsh, I worked with him when he lived in New York. Like we met around 15 years ago through Rick Parker, a mutual friend of ours, and talented trombonist himself. And Sam, and the great thing that I saw when he moved out to Los Angeles around 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, he started to do a lot of pop music, R&B, hip-hop, working with Anderson .Paak and Kendrick Lamar, and he co-wrote the song with Allo Block called The Man, which is a huge hit back in 2011, 2012, around that time. So Sam had a sensibility of songwriting as well as the hip-hop, pop realm, that genre, and also he's a tremendous improviser, as you know. So so I felt I needed his set of ears and he's always been a straight shooter, always been honest. And I like having honesty in my life. I like having people that will let me know, hey, this, you should do it another way. No, this is not right. You should, you know, like give their opinion because it's good. It's good for me to be able to think about all the contributions and what's said and think about it thoroughly. So that's important. So,
it's really interesting because you have such a clear vision of what the music should be and where the trumpet should fit in, and all these different sections in the tunes, and some of them are quite complicated, but at the same time it does have the feeling of kind of a pop record. So that must have been what you're talking about when you're talking about Sam.
Yes.
You wanted to bring in
something different,
something from that
right
part of your,
and make it an album experience. Like right. How pop albums are like an album, and I had a couple of interludes. I have an intro and a couple of interludes on the record, and also too, Quincy Jones. That's who inspired me because he's like my ultimate musical hero, and I've never met him actually. And his albums like Walking in Space, The Dude, Body Heat, Back on the Block. I was 12 years old when that came out, and that's when I started following hip hop with Big Daddy Kane and KRS-One and Eric B. Rakim and Public Enemy got me into hip hop, Chuck D, and those cats. And then with having an album with Ella Fitzgerald and Big Daddy Kane and Ice-T, and it's like, whoa, you know, and Miles, it's like, like that kind of cornucopia, you know, a plethora of talent and music that stands the test of time in American history, not just music history, but American history. You know, I that inspired me to, you know, like, and as I've grown as a musician and been in so many different experiences, I felt like, okay, like, that influence of Quincy Jones came to me, and it hit
the trumpet players.
Yeah, right. Yes, yes, indeed.
Wow, that is so great. All right, we've been dancing around this issue of your life as an interviewer, and you're a really good interviewer. So I was trying to like get that hat on today to get my game up to interview Navate.
It's great.
but sports talk. Television and radio, and you gave me this clip of your interview with Mike Krzyzewski, mm-hmm. and it's pretty inspiring. And you set him up for the he was like a definite assist, and he takes the ball and runs.
You've coached at Duke for around 34
years. Yes, almost at 35. So I was somewhat close.
It's seeming like it so far.
But now that's over a generation. How have you been able to change with the times, especially with a different type of student athlete than the student athletes you recruited back in the early
years? That's a great question. Actually, it's a question that could lead to an entire 60-minute show or more.
Oh, that'd be great. I don't mind.
Yeah, but the and it's a great question, and I think it speaks to what a leader must do to adapt, or a parent must do to adapt. With if you have like six kids, and one of them's 18, and one of them's three. The one you brought up at 18 is going to, the one at 3 is going to be brought up a little bit differently. And so you have to constantly adapt. And so over these three decades, we've tried to adapt to the changing culture that these kids come from, while recognizing that they still want to develop the same values of honesty, teamwork, integrity, loyalty. All those things are alive and well with every generation, with every group of youngsters. It's just that they come from a little bit different culture. And so how you try to teach those values is going to be a little bit different. And but it's a learning process, and sometimes by trial and error. And I've enjoyed that. Actually, it keeps you fresh. And it keeps you a little bit more current.
Pop culture and the music.
Well, not completely, but a little bit. At least I know some of the names, and you do have to be in their world. You know, for them, yeah, I'm 66 years old, and I coach kids who are 18 to 22. So I'm at least three times older than my oldest player, and so it's up to me to make some adjustments, not just for the, and they have to make adjustments too. So we adapt to one another.
That's powerful stuff. Yes. Did you know you wanted to go there when you talked to him?
Yes, indeed, because I'm a Duke fan and been a Coach K fan since 1987. That's when I followed college basketball, and always admired how he carried himself on the sidelines. Never, you know, he was just regal, has a regalness to him, and I've been a fan of his since 87, so over 30 years, and I interviewed him back in 2013, and he gave me 11 minutes, like, and this was at a press conference, and I just saw him walking and started talking with him, and he really appreciated the interview, I could tell, and he just, I could have interviewed him for another 10 minutes, probably,
wow.
But that was a dream, and I had those questions in my mind, you know. When I was talking,
you know a lot about basketball and a lot about the league.
yeah, and then college and
so,
all sports.
For anyone who doesn't know, Nabate stumped the Schwab. So it was a sort of a contestant show where there were sports trivia questions presented in different ways, and the host was this guy named Schwab.
Then
you would go up against him, and very few people actually ever beat him. But
that's
you're
right.
One of those people.
That's right.
What was the question that you beat him on?
Oh, wow. Well, it was the Schwab Showdown, and I have the largest margin of victory ever still from the history of that show. 11-4, I defeated him.
Uh-huh.
So it was like a segment where you go back and forth where he picks a question for me to answer, and I pick a question, and it was three...
From preset questions, or you make
preset,
it up?
Preset questions,
so
yeah.
You had a selection of questions.
Exactly, uh-huh. And it was four topics, three questions each. I think, yeah, four topics, three questions each. So I one of the topics was Roy Jones, because I'm a big boxing fan, and Roy Jones Jr. is like my favorite boxer ever. So when I saw that as a category, I knew not to have him answer those Roy Jones questions.
You had to have him ask you those
exactly,
questions.
Exactly. So smart. And they were tactical. And they were easy too, like those questions. But yeah, it was just a great experience. And I'm friends with Howie to this day. Like, I actually just spoke to him a couple weeks ago. He's such a great man and very humble.
Was that the beginning of your entry into talk sports stuff, things?
Exactly. That was
so out of that grew Sirius XM and the current show that you have so much to talk about.
Exactly. The current show I started a year later. I started that show on Manhattan Cable and just, you know, took advantage of the platform to be able to televise your material free and be able to express yourself and everything. And I felt like, hey, I have a lot to talk about with sports and some music too. I've had musicians on the show. Mm-hmm. I've talked about music and I try to, when I interview people, try to ask them about music, you know, and everything and how they feel about it. And when I can.
Clyde.
Yeah. 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 Yes, collaboration. Yeah. So definitely, it was great. And then ended up working, producing with Sirius XM years later and everything. And,
And so you're carrying these parallel careers of sports talk television show and a touring band leader, trumpet player.
And now I have a better balance now because for years earlier, that's the thing. Going back to your question about my first album, I didn't have the concentration to be able to really put all of my effort and energy into it. And I knew for something like this, my first album, it has to be on point. It has to me, it has to be on point.
Sure.
And I hope it's on point to many other people, you know. But I felt like I had a high standard, which I had to reach. So definitely.
Interesting. But wow. It's just so funny the same thing happened to me, actually, early on when I made what I think of as my first recording as leader, and it never came out. And I still have probably 200 copies on cassette.
Wow.
You know, demos. But I could never get a deal and it never came out. And I guess I look back and if I were to hear it now, I'd probably go, okay, well, maybe they were right. I should have waited. I wasn't ready.
Well, or maybe you could reissue it. You know,
when you see it out there, you can judge for yourself. But I think, like you, part of the challenge for me also was having so many influences and loving all kinds of music and wanting it to all be represented. And I must confess, I don't know that much about basketball. Mm-hmm. 1 year I decided, okay, I'm going to follow college basketball this year. Because I have so many friends that are into it. And I was like, I started like checking it out. And then I would like open the paper. And I was like, there's so many games.
Yes.
How could you possibly? I was like, I can either continue being a mediocre trumpet player with the little time that I have, or I can become a full-time college basketball fan. So it didn't take.
Over 300 teams in Division I alone.
Yeah,
you know,
like all the rules, and it's so complex. And then there's the employment issues with the players.
Ooh, that's a whole other thing.
Right?
Yeah, a whole other thing. Yeah.
Talk to people about that?
Oh, yeah. There's all, you know, there's a tug of war on whether players should get paid. Now it looks like the one and done rule is going to be like irrelevant now.
What is one and done?
Where students have pretty much 1 year. You can go to college for 1 year and then you can go into the NBA draft. But you can't go straight from high school to college to the pros anymore.
Really?
Can't do that anymore.
Why
so
did
the NBA,
they stop that?
Yeah, like the NCAAs and the NBA kind of came together and made a decision because the quality of basketball in the professional league ranks were going downhill a little bit. So
I see. So they felt like they needed more experience to be with the NCAA.
Exactly. And now it looks like it's going to come back. And now with the G League, which is like a developmental league for the NBA, it looks like now a lot of these top prospects could go straight to the G League and develop in it's like a minor league system. and I then see. Come up to the pros. So it's a very interesting dynamic.
That's more the way baseball does it, right?
Yeah. Baseball with the minor leagues. Yep, absolutely. Right. And
probably football in Europe.
Like football. Well, here, the good thing, students have to stay for 3 years because
talking about American football now.
And soccer. Soccer has like leagues that are under, you know,
farm teams
and stuff like that. Kids who are national teams too, as well, where kids can hone their craft, you know, at 16, 17 years old, you know.
Cool.
But
okay, so back to the music, Nabate. And I noticed that I see you sometimes you spell your name with an accent over the E because it's N-A-B-A-T-E. Mm-hmm. And then people were saying Nabate.
Yeah, a lot of times. Yeah.
Right. So I see the accent. Okay, Nabate. Good. Okay. So now what I was saying about having so many different interests is also about musical interests. Mm-hmm. And there's a track on the record where you reference Albon Berg.
Yes.
And quote from his – and I did some listening and some digging, and I couldn't quite – give me a little more time, and I'll figure it out. But I had to come and ask you. So let me just play a little bit of this minute pieces of Wozzeck.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's just a short excerpt of the piece where you're quoting Wozzeck, Albon Berg.
Yes.
And Michael Mayo is singing and...
Yeah, he's...
So tell me, how did this work for you? What is he?
Well, I got to say, Wozzeck has always been my favorite. Wozzeck and Lulu both are my favorite operas. And I came across those operas in college at Eastman School of Music. And I'm so glad I went up there because I was part of the jazz program, which was just starting the undergraduate program, but it's still a classically based school where I would interact with mostly classical musicians. So I really learned so much about the art form, and then opera singers, you know, would talk about their favorite operas and things like that, and I would listen. But Berg, like his sound, very, very jazz influenced, you know, and so ahead of his time. And of course, as we all know, Nazi Germany ostracized his music, you know, pretty much because of that influence, you know.
You really think he was influenced by jazz?
I think, or maybe
vice versa.
It could be more vice versa, actually. Yeah, because harmonically he was so advanced for his time, you know. Yeah, but definitely, I think jazz was influenced by him, but definitely Stravinsky, Stravinsky and him were like parallel in their influences, and of course Schoenberg, of course, you know, was an influence. But they were. they loved jazz. They loved like the artists, especially, you know, Charlie Parker and bebop, and also the swing era and everything, which led to bebop, which was because Berg's opera was written, that came out in 1937.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, 1937.
To confirm.
Voltsek. So it was kind of 1935. Yeah.
Oh.
So yeah, so it came out then. So.
And you don't see them as this is like separate styles. Like, to you, this is all just music that you carry around on your phone and in your head and in your heart. So the stylistic thing isn't so much of it. Because, I mean, it kind of hit me in the middle of the record. But where you placed it is perfect.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And then the last line on the record, that minor third sequence right there, which is used all the time in improvised music and jazz. So
I'm going to go on with this same piece, just the next a next little section of it, because it goes through so many changes, and I find it really interesting. So it's I mentioned before, it's Michael Mayo is the singer on this, but Stacey Dillard is playing soprano sax.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And plays an incredible solo
on
this track. And do you go way back with him as well?
Or? Yes, absolutely. We met through Alan J. Palmer, who, you know, comes out of the J-Mac school, Jackie McLean school. And Alan, like, worked with like a lot of younger musicians like myself. This was around 2003, 2004, around that time, where you had people like myself, Josh Evans, Lakeisha Benjamin, Amin Saleem, Stacey Dillard. A lot of us were hanging out, you know, just hanging out. Like, he had a studio in Washington Heights, and he would have jam sessions, and we would hang, and that's how I met Stacey. He moved to New York just at that time.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Interesting. That I never knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So who was the ringleader of all of this?
Oh, Alan J. Palmer, great pianist who played with Jackie McLean in the 90s.
Oh, okay.
And Roy Hargrove. And yeah, like so Alan J., I haven't talked to him in such a long time.
Yeah.
I have to look him up and call him and see how he's doing. So.
And you were also, you told me back in the day, you were working, I don't know if it ever happened, you were working on this film about Lee Morgan.
Yeah, never. I've 3 years of my life. And that
remember
was,
you were deep in that.
Deep in that. Just never got the funding for it. And it's funny, everyone says, oh, did you see They Call Him Morgan? You know, did you see that film? And I just can't watch it.
Because you worked on a project about Lee, but your movie would have been a very different theme.
Yeah, it would have been very different. Film. It would have been kind
of that film is fantastic. It's powerful.
I've heard, but I just because I was so immersed into
really
it
invested,
and it didn't work out, and I just maybe when I'm in my 80s or 90s I'll watch it then.
Well, I think compared to producing an album, I mean that. It's already so much work, but I can imagine producing a film is exponentially more complicated and expensive and time-consuming and more people involved and
just
a huge endeavor. So you got all these people together. Everybody played at the same time? on this, or are there overdubs? Or?
Yeah, different. Like I had 25 musicians overall for the project, so each it was different. Different groups each tune.
So each tune, but they're played live. It's not like anybody's overdubbing. Or,
oh yeah, it was live. There were like two tracks that were overdubbed, and that was it. Just those two. Yeah, no, three tracks, and that was it. Just we're overdubbing. Laid Back, because Elzai was all the way out in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Great MC, very underrated, from Detroit originally. Mm-hmm. And so we did, you know, how they do it now in pop and R&B and hip-hop. Send the stems over. He, you know, puts his verse on it. Then I listen to it and like, okay, you know. And
everything's by email or Dropbox or Dropbox, whatever.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Hytale or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. But wow. most of the tracks, around 10, 11 tracks, are live.
Yeah.
Live at Bunker Studio.
Like great. This Votsek piece.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sounds like it's live.
Yep.
So I want to play the last little sequence. Because, well, first we'll start from the trumpet solo. And it's you and two drummers.
Yes, indeed.
So it's Nate Smith and Jonathan Blake.
Yes, indeed. And then Brad Jones comes in with a little something too. So after
yeah. But then this whole thing about the end of the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. We'll just listen a little bit. About how you broke that down from the opera.
Ooh.
And turned it into that.
You know what, Dave? I thought briefly, I was like, I would want to do an entire album on that opera, but that would have been four CDs or something. So much music I couldn't take out, you know, like, so I just used the opening scene because that hit me hard when I first heard it. I was like, whoa, like just the intensity of that opera. And so I just took basically the opening scene of the first.
Is there a particular recording of that opera that you'd recommend if people hear this and get curious?
Yeah, Pierre Boulez conducting it. Yeah,
great.
Pierre Boulez with the Paris Lyric Opera, I believe. You
okay.
know, but he conducted
great.
It. Yeah, great version of it. So
you just took the themes. but mm-hmm. you translated them to this electric band.
Yes.
And gave yourself a trumpet solo with two drummers.
Right.
So yeah. Simple, as you do. You know, everybody does that.
And then Zapp, like Roger Troutman, Zapp. I've always been a fan of Zapp, you know, from the 80s, you know, like that whole, and I had Michael Mayo, like, do a lot of, like, you know, electric, so, and he does great things with effects. So that's what really made me interested in having him. And
on
so
that track we heard, I mean, is he doing it live? The effects?
Yes, he was. Wow. He was, yeah. And then we added some during the mix as well. So
all of those elements in this piece, and I hate to keep harping on this piece, we'll move on and listen to another track. But it's it seems to me like I was doing some thinking about the record, and I've known you for quite a while.
A long time, yeah.
Like finding your voice, is that right?
1997. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a little while. But it just feels like, you know, a moment of finding your voice and just deciding to go for it. And this is on NSI Universal label, which is your label. And I just think it's great. Just go do it, you know. And I hear this track and it just feels like, okay, you're believing it and you're taking the bull by the horns and taking some risks in the music and doing novel and unique things. And it makes me feel like, from having met you at Eastman, you know, part of that is about finding, quote unquote, your voice.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
So important.
Does that feel like a part of this project is that, finding it?
It's important because I've always prided myself on being different. You know, being unique, because there's 6 billion people in the world. Everyone's different. You know, even siblings and even twins are different. You know, I just feel like it's so important. From, you know, I've always tried to take all the influences and try to create my own voice, and I strive to do that. And I'm still a work in progress. That's for sure. Until the day I die,
know,
until the day I die. So I want to, at least I want to start that journey.
Do you feel the same as a trumpet player?
Yes, absolutely. As a trumpeter, yes. A musician, yes.
In terms of finding your own voice and your own sound, and everybody talks differently about how that happens and how was that a conscious effort on your part, or do you feel like it's something that just sort of happened?
I think it happened from the standpoint of I've always wanted to. I think subconsciously I've always geared towards being that way. But consciously, for example, I'll go months without listening to a trumpet player. Like I'll listen to other instruments.
And
for
that's
sure.
Intentional. Because you don't want to be influenced, or you don't want to carry the...
Right.
Huh.
And then there are times I'll come back to listening to trumpeters.
Yeah.
And then I'll go back out of not listening. I'm very, it's kind of like a, for lack of a better term, love versus hate. I couldn't come up with a better term, because I certainly don't hate hearing trumpet players, you know?
Yeah. So. I don't know. It's funny that way. I guess I'm the same. Everybody goes through phases of listening to different things. When I'm writing new music, I rarely listen to other stuff. I listen to a lot of trumpet players from working on the trumpet festival, from just traveling around and just knowing a lot of people. And a lot of trumpet players send me their music, which is really, I'm grateful for that. I get to hear a lot of things. And relating to what you were just saying, I sort of feel like it's more like I hear other players. And it's not even me judging if I like it or not. Just hearing it and going, wow, that's different. That's another way to do this. And then I go back to my horn and I'm like, okay, well, I'm stuck. This is the way I do it. And it's not like anybody else. But it's – I don't know. I find that really inspiring, hear somebody do it a totally different way.
Right, right.
And just think about why – think about how they – go about finding that. I find that interesting. And so, you know, you finding your voice and making this record feels very much like, you know, a process of having been on a million projects and seen a million people do it and seek. You have this track with Alida Moses, the singer. And I want to play some of it because she's such a beautiful voice. Mm-hmm. Yes, but indeed. Also your writing is really intense on this.
Oh,
like very involved section writing and strings, mm-hmm. and the way the voices work. And then you play a very unusual solo on it. So I'm going to play like a 2 or 3 minute excerpt from Find Your Light.
Find your light, start to have it shine so bright. Oh, find your light and take it up to full flight. Need to find your light illuminating in the sky. Oh, find your light, express yourself and fly high. All of us, we have gifts to present and to inspire. Touch every soul around us. What's a light that we can't fully bring for enlightenment? Look inside and discover what you believe in. Then spread your wings. There's truth of what makes us feel whole, of what makes us feel right, of what makes us feel blessed.
Find Your Light. So first of all, the writing, what possessed you to come up with such a complex passage?
Oh, wow. I have to say that what influenced me first, I wrote the lyrics as well. And it's the first time I ever had lyrics publicly performed.
Wow.
So
it's really hard.
And and I'm very – Dave, when it comes to lyrics, you have great lyricists throughout the test of time, you know, like Stevie Wonder and Bob Dylan, and then before that, George Gershwin and, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and, you know, all those mm-hmm. great writers and everything, a great lyricists, you know. And then, of course, great libretto of the great operas of the past. So I just felt like, whoa, like if I'm going to write some lyrics, I just was saying it has to have a message. And my message was to find your light. Find what you do and what you love, and you do it. You love what you do, do what you love. And that's what the message was. And kind of like going throughout my life, I've only wanted to do what I've loved, you know, like mm-hmm. music and sports. Those are two things I love. Now, I've always wanted to be involved in those two. But music still is the foundation for me because it really made me the man who I am today in everything I've done. So Find Your Light was all about that. And I felt like that message I had to put out there for sure, because so many people I've been around, 95% of them don't like what they do at all, you know, like people say like, oh, I wish I played music. I said, well, it's never too late. You just have to be around it and you have to practice and set up, you know, like set up a consistency. Like it's all in us, you know, music and art is all in us. You just have to like follow it and be around others that do it and get inspired. And that's important. So yeah, so that's where Find Your Light, that's where it originated from.
That's a beautiful message, but I still feel like I'm going to push a little harder and ask about that bridge. And
yeah.
Because it's not just the lyric. There's all this key changes and modulations and syncopations going on with the string section. And so I guess my question, and I'm coming at you like as a composer myself, is like just what made you make the decision to be like, okay, this is what needs to be here?
Yeah, I think
it's just and I'm just saying that because I'm hearing it going, wow, okay, I'm happy to be here. I don't know how I got here. I don't know how I'm going back, but, you know, I trust you.
That's what I love about, like, bridges of what I love. Those are the sections, like, when you listen to pop music, how a great bridge, how it
transitions.
It deviates, you know. And also, too, there's that tension, because tension and release is what I love in music, too. You know, you have to have that tension. tension, because life is about tension. The struggles that we go through to be able to accomplish and what we envision is that's the tension. And Find Your Light, you know, once again, the message is like people have that tension and trying. There's so much resistance in being able to go for what you love and what you believe in. There's what other people think. There's situations. There's, you know, okay, all types of things. Like,
right. But so we're now we're tension. Back to the poetry. So and I'm. No complaints. No complaint. But I guess what you're saying is that the message and then the further development and mm-hmm. complexity of the message itself
yes.
is what got you to the composition table.
And then I love extended chords too. Yeah. That's another thing. I love like altered chords, extended chords, and I wanted to have that be the basis.
Okay, so one more question about this then, because it's also hard. Mm-hmm. So, and you had a whole band of people on that particular track, which you got like 12 people in the studio.
Basically, yeah.
Something like
string
that.
Quartet and, yeah, and then rhythm section, Alita and myself. Yeah, around nine
people.
Yeah.
So, and that's a take. Did you have a lot of rehearsals?
We did. Yeah, we rehearsed for a couple of days. Oh, yeah, okay. A couple of days.
Because everyone sounds so comfortable with it. I mean, it exactly. just flows.
Exactly. And then naturally. I got people the music ahead of time, of mm-hmm, course, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was important, like, because I used, like, pretty much a week time, you know, a week period, you know, before... before we ended up recording like 2 or 3 days of rehearsal, and then we recorded. So, because I know people's schedules are so hectic and busy,
yeah. Yeah.
So we made the most out of the rehearsals, and I made sure I scheduled everything and organized everything.
Wow!
And Frank Lacy, you know, Kumba,
producer
like
hat.
Roots, yeah. He produced exactly producer hat, and what he said on a mini documentary on the album, what he said was really that meant a lot to me. He said that. He's done hundreds of record dates, but nothing as organized as this date. You know, like cats will know the time of the rehearsal, you mm-hmm. know, like time that each musician comes in, you mm-hmm. know, like at mm-hmm. 2 o'clock or whatever, and then have the schedule of the recording session, like that organization. Mm-hmm. When he said that, because he's played with everybody, yeah, you know, so it's like that really.
And he plays a great solo on this tune that I want to get to.
Yes, indeed.
But, wow, that's that's an important part of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Maybe that comes from being a television producer.
Yes, radio and television, yeah, having to structure things and everything. Yeah, that's important. And mm-hmm. yeah, and that's why it was good for me to do this album now, because I all those things, and going back to the Lee Morgan film, learning how to fundraise, learning how to, you know, learning how to organize what you give, you know, a business plan, how mm-hmm. to have that organized, how to have all your T's crossed and your I's dotted. You know, well, most of your T's crossed and your I's dotted. Yeah. Right. Nothing could be perfect, you know. So, so that was the key. And just all those things I learned from being in other elements, other elements of life.
Yeah.
Really helped me, and I think it's best that I did it now than instead of coming out at 28 years old. Would it mm-hmm. even been, mm-hmm. you know, and also know about publicity and knowing about, you know, promotions and things like that. Like,
so how do people find this record? Speaking of which.
Yes, indeed. It's on all digital music platforms, on iTunes, Google Play, mm-hmm. Amazon, Spotify, all that. Mm-hmm. And CDs are available as well, too. If anyone's interested in CDs, they can contact me at Nabate House Trumpet, which is my Facebook page. My website will be coming out soon. So, but Nabate House Trumpet on Facebook or NSI.Universal on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Or Nabate House SMTA on Twitter.
Okay.
Excuse me.
No, we got every platform covered. Mm-hmm. Well, not every platform. How would I reach you on Snapchat? No, I'm just kidding.
No, I'm staying away from that. Yeah. That's too much.
So, I just want to wrap this up and say thank you again for being with me and turning me on to all this music. You've been playing in the Festival of New Trumpet Music over the years, and now you know, helping us out, organizing, getting our T's crossed and our I's dotted, and we're very grateful for that.
And I'll never forget the thank you for the commission. That was one of the moments of my career. Oh,
in
wonderful.
2008. That was
I'm
10
so
years
happy
ago.
To hear that.
Yeah, like to receive a commission to tune. I wrote, "We need unity in the community."
We're gonna have to bring that one back.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Indeed.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, and we podcast listeners, we sort of talked about this before we started recording. Was that there are some statement-oriented pieces on the album, and we decided we were not going to let that guy drag us into those. But it's something that I know Nabate is really dear for you. Mm-hmm. And you recorded Strange Fruit on the album, and it's haunting.
Yeah,
really, especially now. But I'm glad that that piece, what was it again? We need unity in the community.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that is something that is more and more important.
That's right.
Functified. Mm-hmm. Speaking of unity in the community, the horn section work on this is great.
Oh, thank you.
Is it? It's just three horns?
Just three horns, yeah.
Sounds so full.
Yeah, yeah.
And the lines are great.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah. Frank takes an amazing solo.
Yes, indeed. Roots.
So you know, like, do you feel like, I mean, I guess maybe stupid question, but, you know, string writing, your rhythm section writing, now horn section writing, is that something that you do you credit Eastman with having gotten those skills, or is that something that you picked up in the business going along?
Wow, great question. I started actually arranging in high school. Started arranging big band in high school at LaGuardia Music and Art Performing Arts. Justin Jichocho, he said, "Yeah, if you have any charts, bring them by." Because I would ask him, and and so I wrote a few charts during that time, and then. Really, like Jimmy Owens was someone that influenced me because he's such a great arranger, and he would have me check out books like Inside the Score and check out orchestration books like Rimsky-Korsakov book, which is still like, you know, a gem, you know, of a book.
Absolutely.
Samuel Adler orchestration book as well. Mm-hmm. And then at Eastman, just really built because I looked at all the scores and looked at all the scores that were around, you know, and I worked at the Ensemble Library there for 3 years.
Oh, okay.
So I just would take out scores and check them out and analyze them. And and I've always would enjoy that. So throughout, I think from high school on, I just would learn different things. And then through my experiences, my professional experiences, things I would like, and of course the music I would listen to and be a part of.
And so that brings us to Functified.
Yeah.
Nabate, thanks so much for doing this. It's been great talking
Thank
to
you. Thank
you,
Dave. Honor. Thank great you for having
out.
Me.
Absolutely. Wonderful album.
Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. We'll go out with Functified, and that's Frank Lacy on trombone. Mm-hmm.